Freescalar field on FRW spacetime as a toy model for the fluctuations. So I'll just write the action again. And in the FRW coordinates, so our goal today is essentially going to be to quantize this system and talk about how to compute the quantum mechanical predictions for what the amplitude of the fluctuations should be. Okay, so the first step towards quantizing this is to get it into a form in which it looks familiar, in which it looks just like we're going to get it into a form which looks like a time-dependent harmonic oscillator. So the things we want to get rid of are these extra factors of a squared that separate the space and the time parts, and this overall factor of a cubed. So we're just going to do some field redefinitions and changes of variables to do that. So the first step is to go to conformal time. We change from t to tau using the familiar definition of conformal time. So we have to change both the time derivatives using the chain rule and the integral to make it over d tau instead of the time. And when you do that, the effect is simply to put the space and the time derivatives on a more equal looking footing. Okay, so now the integral is over d tau, and the prime here means derivative with respect to tau. And the effect of this has been to essentially eliminate the 1 over a squared in front of the gradients. Okay, the next step is to get rid of this 1 over a squared factor by essentially just canonically normalizing the field. So we define the so-called Mukhanov variable, which is simply, we'll call it nu, and it's simply the canonically normalized version of phi. So this is named after Slava Mukhanov, who was one of the first people to do this calculation of the primordial density perturbations that you'd expect from inflation. Okay, so we plug this new variable in, and now the action takes the following form. Okay, so we eliminate the 1 over a, the overall a squared part at the expense of introducing this part, a double prime over a, which sort of looks like a time-dependent mass for the field. So in order to find these, you're plugging this into here and doing out the time derivatives, and you get terms that look like, you'll find terms that look like a prime over a times nu prime nu, things with one derivative of nu coming from expanding this out. So to deal with this, you essentially have to integrate by parts. You just you write this as 1 half a prime over a times d by d tau of nu squared. And then you integrate the d by dt by parts. And that's what gives you the second derivative of a. Okay, so the point of doing all this was that now this theory looks like, even though this is still the scalar field on a curved FRW background, it looks just like a scalar field on flat space, with the exception of this mass term, which depends on the time. So it's essentially a scalar field with a time-dependent mass, and a scalar field in Fourier space is nothing but a collection of harmonic oscillators. So to quantize this, what we have to do is learn how to quantize a harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent frequency. Okay, so that's what we're going to do now. We're going to take a slight interlude and talk about just the plain old simple harmonic oscillator, but with a time-dependent frequency. And this example of the harmonic oscillator, it illustrates essentially everything you need to know about quantum field theory in curved space. If you understand this, you understand quantum field theory in curved space. All the essential features are there. Okay, so let's start with an interlude for the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. So we're going to start with the Lagrangian, which is 1 half q dot squared minus 1 half omega squared q squared. But we're going to allow the frequency omega to be some fixed given function of time, which we're going to leave arbitrary. Okay, so it's a solvable system. It's a quadratic system. It's just that you have explicit time dependence in the Lagrangian. So in particular, energy is not going to be conserved. And as we'll see, the notion of particle number is not going to be well defined. Okay, so the equations of motion that follow from this are just the ordinary simple harmonic oscillator equations, but with this time-dependent frequency. And the first step towards quantizing this is we want to get this in terms of creation annihilation operators, as we know how to do for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. And the first step towards doing that is to define a product or an inner product in quotes on the space of solutions of the equations of motion. So this inner product is defined as follows. If I have two solutions to the equations of motion, F1 and F2, we define this. So we have complex solutions in general. This is the anti-symmetrized second derivative between the two, the anti-symmetrized time derivative product, rather. And this you might recognize as just the Wronskian. And sometimes we write this using this notation of a time derivative with two arrows, like so. Okay, so what this is, I have inner product in quotes here because it's not really an inner product. It's a non-degenerate anti-symmetric bilinear form. So it's linear in the two arguments. It's not symmetric like an inner product would be. It's anti-symmetric. And it's also non-degenerate in the sense that if you take a linearly independent set of solutions and you form a matrix between all of them, you'll find that matrix is non-degenerate. It doesn't have zero determinant. So it's anti-symmetric. It's not an inner product. What it really is the symplectic product on the phase space of this system, if you know anything about the Hamiltonian mechanics. But for our purposes, what it's going to do is provide a normalization condition that's convenient for defining the creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so in particular, suppose we have a solution to this, which is normalized such that this product is 1. So I should also say that this product is independent of the time at which you evaluate it. So I've got this evaluated at time t equals 0, but it doesn't matter which time you evaluate it on, because you can pretty much straightforwardly show that if your solution actually is a solution to the equation of motion, that this product is time independent. Okay, so suppose we're given a solution f such that the inner product of f with itself is normalized to be 1. In that case, you can show, again straightforwardly from this definition, that the conjugate f star will then be linearly independent, a linearly independent solution. And that follows essentially from the properties of the Wronskian. And we'll have that f star with itself gives a product of minus 1. So again, this is another sign that this is not a true inner product, because you have something which is squaring to minus 1. It's more properly a symplectic product. And the inner product of f with f star will be 0. Okay, so given a solution f with this property, we automatically get a linearly independent solution. Since it's a second order equation, we know that those two solutions now span the entire space of solutions. So we can write any solution we like as a linear combination of f and f star. Okay, so we have any solution we like of the equations Q of t. I can write as a linear combination of our f with a coefficient that I'll call a sub f, and then a sub f dagger times f star. Okay, so the full solution has to be real. So that constrains the coefficient of the f star to be the dagger of the coefficient of f. So as far as classical solutions, these are just numerical coefficients, and this is just the conjugate of this. If we're talking about the quantum system, these q now is an operator, and these a's are now operators, and this a is the Hermitian conjugate of that a. So these are just the creation and annihilation operators associated with this particular solution f. Okay, so we can also write expressions for the canonical momentum of the field. So the canonical momentum p is defined as the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to q dot, which in our case is just q dot. So all I have to do is differentiate this with respect to time to get the canonical momentum. So this is A times F dot plus A dagger dot, like so. Okay, so now to quantize this, we declare that these are operators, and that they, and we want them to satisfy the equal time commutation relations equals I in units where h bar is 1. We can now you can just evaluate the, this, you can, well, this is going to be equivalent to demanding that the A's satisfy the usual operator equations for creation or annihilation operators. Okay, so you can easily show both sides of this equivalence by just using the properties that we have here of the Wronskian. So I'll show how to go this way. If we assume these commutation relations for the A and A daggers, we should show that this commutation relation for the position and momentum follows. So to do that, let's just evaluate Q with P. So I'll leave out the subscripts F for now, just because they will clutter up. So Q and P, we're just going to plug in what these expressions are. So we have 8F, A dagger, F dagger for Q, and then F dot, A dagger, F star dot for P. And now we expand it out. So A with A commutes to zero, so we don't need that term. A dagger with A dagger commutes to zero. We don't need that term. All we get are the cross terms. These. And now we use the postulated commutation relations of the A with the A dagger. This one is 1. This one is the flipped guy. It's minus 1. So this becomes just F dot star minus F star F dot. And this you recognize just as this inner product up there. This is just I times what we had defined as the inner product of F with itself. And by our normalization condition for F, this is just 1. So we get our desired answer for the commutator of Q with P. Okay, so you can go the other way if you like as well. You can use this inner product to extract the coefficient A and A dagger from any solution. So given any solution, you can write the coefficient A as the inner product F with Q. And you can write A dagger as minus F dagger with respect to Q. So you can show this straightforwardly from the definition of the inner product and from these expansions that we have here for Q. And then if you like, you can show the other side of this equivalence by assuming this and then calculating the commutator of this A with the A dagger and working out from the definitions, and you'll find the other side of that equivalence. Okay, so quantizing this now has been reduced to essentially finding a representation of these operators A with A dagger. And these are just the ordinary creation annihilation operator commutators. So we can carry over the same apparatus that we know from the ordinary simple harmonic oscillator. So we define a ladder of states. So we define a vacuum state which it's all associated with the solution F, so we'll call it an F vacuum, and we'll label it 0 sub F, and this has the property that it's annihilated by the annihilation operator. And then we build up the tower of states by applying the creation operator n times, so the nth excited state has the same expression as for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. Like so. And we can define an F number operator. Which we'll call NF. And we'll define it such that it has the same expression as from the familiar harmonic oscillator. And this has the property now that these number states are eigenvalues of the number operator. With eigenvalue n. Okay, so this is now a quantization of this simple harmonic oscillator. Given any solution f, you can create, you have these operators A and A dagger associated with the solution. You've now got a Hilbert space, so you know how to represent those operators, and you can find the action of any of these operators, Q or P, or any products of them, by writing them in terms of the creation and annihilation operators and using this known action on the space of states. Okay, so all of this hinged on choosing a particular function f. This choice of function f, however, is not unique. It's not fixed by this normalization condition. There are other possible functions you might use instead of f that satisfy all the conditions that we just wrote down. Okay, so because of this ambiguity, suppose we used a different function instead. So instead of f, we have some g, some solution g of t instead. So g also satisfies this same normalization condition. We now have associated with g, we also have creation and annihilation operators. So we can do the same thing. We can write Q of t as an expansion in terms of the G creation and annihilation operators. Like so. And we can do the same for the momentum. And the same sort of relation will follow if we assign the same sort of commutation relations for the G operator. Okay, so we can just as well quantize and build a Hilbert space based upon these G operators. So we can define, for example, a G vacuum in the same way, which we'll call 0 G, and this is annihilated by the G annihilation operator. and we can define G number states by building with G creation operators on top of the G vacuum. And then there's going to be a G number operator. Which is defined in the same way in terms of the G creation operator, for which these are our eigenvectors. Okay, so there's nothing a priori that tells you that F is any better than G as far as quantizing this system. So the notion of, in quantum field theory, these number states are particle states. You talk about a state having one particle if it's been created out of the vacuum using one creation operator, and two particles is created out of the vacuum with two creation operators, and so on. But the notion about which, about how many particles there are is ambiguous in general, because the solutions, these modes associated with the different, with the creation annihilation operators that create the particles, that choice of modes is ambiguous. So the notion of particle is ambiguous. So it's only in very special situations where you have an unambiguous notion of what particles are, like situations like Flatt-Minkowski space, where you can talk about a particle as a representation of the underlying symmetry group. So that's often how quantum field theory is first taught. You learn about the representations of the Poincaré group, and these are supposed to be the particle states. This is, if you read Weinberg's field theory book, this is the point of view he takes. He starts just with representations and talking about particles, and then sort of builds up from quantum fields. But as soon as you go to a situation which is not as symmetrical, a situation like a FRW universe or a more complicated curved space with no symmetries, for example, this notion ceases to be useful. So the reality is there's a quantum field. That's the object that's there. And sometimes it gets interpreted as particles in very in certain conditions. But in other times, that interpretation is ambiguous. Different observers will have different sets of natural mode functions that they would like to use, and will disagree about how many particles are in a particular state, because they're using different notions of the creation annihilation operators, different notions of the mode functions. Okay, but so. Okay, but we know that at the end of the day, there's just one Hilbert space. There's one quantum system, and these are just two sort of different representations of it, the F and G mode. So we can relate the two. So we know, for instance, that the that whatever this G mode is, it must be expressible as a linear combination of the F modes, because the F modes are complete. So we could write a linear combination, alpha F plus beta F star, because we know that these Fs form a complete set, so there's some coefficient alpha and beta that I can use to write G in terms of F. And you can go the other way if you like as well, writing F in terms of G. So these things are known as Bogoliubov coefficients. And they essentially tell you how to relate these different descriptions to each other. Okay, so in particular, the G normalization condition gives you a constraint on what the alpha and the beta have to be. We have to have alpha squared minus beta squared is equal to 1. This comes from, well, you have to use this constraint and the same constraint for f. So we can also relate now the creation and annihilation operators to each other using the same linear combination and using the fact that Q can be written in terms of either the F or equally well in terms of the G. This, by extracting out the A's using the relation that's up there somewhere, we can relate the creation and annihilation operators of F and G using these same coefficients. Okay, so this immediately tells you that if I have a state which is the vacuum of one of these, like the F vacuum, looked at in terms of G, it's not going to be the vacuum anymore. It's going to have some number of particles. In other words, this tower of F states and this tower of G states, they both span the Hilbert space, but they're not the same basis. There's some transformation you have to do to get between them. So number states in one basis are not number states in the other basis. Okay, so for example, suppose I have the F vacuum and I want to know how many particles of G are in the F vacuum. So I would calculate the expectation value of the G number operator in the F vacuum. So to do this, so the G number operator was just A dagger G times A of G. And now we just plug in our expansion for the AGs in terms of the AFs, because we know how the AFs act on this vacuum. So we'll plug in over here. Okay, so in this inner product, there's only one term we have to keep because AF annihilates the vacuum, A dagger annihilates the vacuum over here. So we only need to keep the AF term here and the A dagger F term over there. So this becomes mod beta squared AF, A dagger F. And now these, we can flip them around using the commutation relations. flip it at the commutator. This goes to 0 because AF is hitting the vacuum. So this whole thing just becomes 1. So the answer for the number of G particles in the F vacuum is just the mod squared of this particular Guliapov coefficient. OK, so it's this effect which is at the heart of all the things like the Hawking's calculation of the emission of quanta from a black hole, or the Unruh effect. If I'm accelerating in Minkowski space, I see a thermal distribution of particles, whereas someone who's not accelerating just sees the vacuum. All of these effects are essentially just this. Different modes are natural to choose for different observers, and those different observers disagree on the number of particles that are in a particular state. And that's just because the number of particles is not an invariant notion in quantum field theory. It's an observer-dependent notion. Okay. So this ambiguity is in general present, but there are certain situations in which there is a natural choice for the basis of modes. So let's see under what conditions that can be. Okay, so you might remember from the ordinary time-independent harmonic oscillator that these number bases are very nice and useful because they happen to be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So here, so far, we haven't said anything about the Hamiltonian or whether these are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. So let's ask the question now, under what conditions are these number states associated with some f actually related to are actually eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. So let's write down the Hamiltonian for this system. So the usual definition is P times Q dot minus the Lagrangian evaluated on in terms of the position and the momentum. So for our system, this is just the usual p squared plus q squared, but with this time-dependent frequency. Okay, so we know already that this Hamiltonian, it depends explicitly on time. So energy is not conserved in the system unless omega happens to be constant. So let's write this now in terms of the creation annihilation operators associated with our modes F. So somewhere erased was our expression for the P's and the Q's in terms of F. We just plug that in, and we get the following expression. This thing. Okay, so let's ask, when is the F vacuum an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian? So we're looking for the condition that H on the vacuum is some eigenvalue lambda times the vacuum again. Okay, so we just want to evaluate F on the vacuum state, and we know how all of these A's are supposed to act on the vacuum state. So H acting on the vacuum. So I can ignore the term here because A annihilates the vacuum. I have to keep this. Over here, I can ignore this term here. This term I can flip into A dagger A by adding the commutator again, and then I can ignore this. So at the end of the day, I only pick up this term and the 1 here. So I get f dot squared, omega squared f squared, times a dagger acting on the vacuum, plus this quantity, f dot squared, omega squared f squared, acting on the vacuum. Okay, so we want this to be lambda times the original vacuum again. So in particular, we need this term to vanish because this state here is linearly independent of the vacuum state here. So we need this coefficient to vanish. Okay, so this is a differential equation that we can solve for f. So we need that f dot has to be plus or minus I omega times f. And omega, remember, depends on time in general. So you can solve this if you like, and you'll get some f, which you get by integrating this omega. But we also know that f has to be a solution to the equations of motion. So f also has to satisfy the original equations of motion, which were that f double dot omega squared f has to be 0. So if we differentiate this with respect to time, so take d by dt of this, we get f double dot equals plus or minus I omega dot f plus or minus I omega f dot. Now, using the equations of motion, I can replace this f double dot see, what do I want to do? I can replace this with like so. And now this is inconsistent with the equations of motion unless omega dot equals 0. Okay, so the only way to have this number vacuum be an actual eigenstate of the Hamiltonian is if your oscillator actually doesn't depend on time and it's just time independent. Okay, so this is the condition under which we have a preferred set of modes and it's preferred because of the fact that it's a eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so in the case where omega is constant, then we can easily solve this, f dot, to give us that f is equal to e to the minus I omega t. And there's two things here. So we've selected the minus sign rather than the plus sign here. And the normalization here and this is because of this condition that f with f has to be 1 in this inner product. So if you solve this differential equation subject to this constraint, you will get these uniquely determined mode functions. Okay, so in the case where the Hamiltonian is time independent, we have this preferred set of mode functions, which gives you a preferred basis of what you call the particle states, which is why when we solve the ordinary harmonic oscillator, this is what we do. And it's essentially because of the underlying symmetry of this case. So omega constant is the only case where you have a time translation symmetry, and you have a conservation of energy. Okay, so a similar thing happens in the quantum field theory on Minkowski space. Minkowski space is a very symmetrical space, maximum number of symmetries. So there you have a preferred notion of particle states, which is based on the condition that the vacuum be Lorentz invariant. And we'll find the same is true for de Sitter space as well. De Sitter is a highly symmetric space. So during inflation, when the space is approximately de Sitter, there's going to be a preferred notion of modes in that case as well. OK, so given this preferred set of modes, we can again write the Q and the P by using the actual expression for the modes. And these you'll recognize as the usual definition that you first learn in quantum mechanics of the position and momentum operators in terms of the creation annihilation operators in where the operators are written in the Heisenberg picture with their time evolution. And then we can show now that the states built from this are in fact eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian in the usual way. Okay, so in the case where the Hamiltonian is time invariant, or the omega is constant, we have this preferred set of modes. But that's not the only condition under which we have a preferred set of modes. We also have a preferred set of modes if omega happens to be time independent, either asymptotically in the far past or asymptotically in the far future. In that case, we can select out modes which happen to have this preferred form either in the far past or in the far future. So this is the case. These are in and out states. So in the case where omega as a function of time has some structure like this. So if I say that omega as a function of time has some structure where it approaches a constant, which we'll call omega in the far past, and then approaches some different value, say, omega out in the far future. And in between, it could be doing whatever crazy stuff. But if you have these asymptotic regions, either in the in or the out, or both, you then have a preferred set of modes. So we have a preferred set of in modes. Which are solutions f, which approach at time goes to minus infinity the modes associated with the constant omega in, which omega approaches as you go to time minus infinity. And you have out modes, which approach as time goes to infinity the form of the modes for a constant omega out. Okay, so for example, so you don't have to have both of these. You could have a situation where where omega is constant only in the far past and then blows up or does something crazy in the future, in which case you would only have in modes and no out modes. Or you could have the reverse situation where omega is going to constant only at t equals plus infinity and it's doing something crazy at minus infinity, in which case you'd only have the out modes and no in modes. Or you could have both. You could have a situation where it's constant in the far past and in the far future, maybe with different values, in which case you'd have both the in modes and the out modes. In that situation, if you have both, then you can expand the out modes as a function of the in modes because you know they are both complete sets of modes. They're just like different choices of f and g here. So there's an expansion of the out modes in terms of the in modes. And similarly for the in modes in terms of the out modes. And these Bogoliubov coefficients, in this case, you'd interpret it as an S matrix. That's if I start with something which is the vacuum in the far past, how many particles is it going to look like it has in the far future? Okay, so in particular, there's going to be a state that we call the in vacuum, which is the state which is annihilated by the A's associated with these in modes. So So this is a state which looks in the far past like it has no particle excitations. So it looks like the vacuum, or looks empty in the far past. But it may not look empty in the far future. So there's going to be in the future, there's going to be some number of particles which that state looks like it has, which is given by computing the out number operator in this in state. And this, by the same calculation that we saw before, is just this Ogulyubov coefficient beta squared. So this is the notion of particle creation by a time-dependent background. We have some omega, which it starts constant in the far past, but then it starts doing stuff, starts imparting energy into the system, and that energy is used to essentially create particles, to create an excited state out of the vacuum state. Okay, so this is at the root of what's going to be happening during inflation. We're going to start with a state in the very far past, which is the vacuum. And then in the far future, we're going to see that it's not the vacuum anymore, and that's why you get fluctuations that are generated, which eventually get seen in the CMB. Okay, so we'll pick up again tomorrow. Any questions? All right, see you tomorrow then.